Welcome to the podcast that takes apart Paul Krugman's New York Times column. Join us as Tom Woods and Bob Murphy teach economics by uncovering and dissecting the errors of Krugman, Nobel Prize winner, newspaper columnist, and destroyer of nations. It's time for Contra Krugman.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Contra Krugman. I'm Tom Woods with Bob Murphy and several other wonderful people because we are recording this particular episode live from the Mises Institute for the Mises University Summer Program. For those of you who don't know, Bob and I have a weekly podcast that we do together in addition to my daily one and Bob's other one. We have one we do together every week called Contra Krugman, and we refute the Krugman New York Times column every single week, and it's fun. So you can check it out at ContraKrugman.com. Well, today we have special guests. Now, you already know Peter Klein and Lucas Engelhardt and Mark Thornton, and they're here to help us take down Krugman. Now, I want to tell you, the only other time we've ever done this show in front of an audience was at the Mises Circle in Seattle in May. Krugman releases two columns a week, Monday and Friday. And that week, on Monday, his column was terrible. And I don't mean terrible wrong, just terrible, not relevant, not something we could apply.
It was also wrong.
And it was also wrong. Not something we could apply Austrian economics to. So Bob and I were, oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? The event's coming up on Saturday. But then Friday morning, you know, like a Christmas present under the tree with a big bow on it, Krugman released the worst, most idiotic column full of so many fallacies. And we just thought, it's just so glorious. We're going to smack this thing. And did we ever. Best episode ever. This week, Krugman released a terrible column on Monday. We thought, well, we know old Paul. Come Friday morning, he's going to bail us out with an awesome column full of zingers and fallacies we can smash. Nope, another terrible one on Friday. So for today,
he's on to you, I think.
Yeah, I think it's almost like he's started to listen to Contra Krugman. So what we've got instead is one of his blog posts. He can't restrain himself from saying things on his blog that we can use. So we're going to use a blog post and use it as a jumping off point. And we're going to jump way off once we get through the original topic. And the blog post is the GOP's original sin, dated July 18th, 2016. And, of course, it will be linked on the show notes page. Those of you who are secretly doing the drinking game, I'm about to tell you the show notes page, ContraKrugman.com/45. All right. Well, it's only this. I mean, look, it's giant font that I printed it out in, and it only goes this far. So the gist of it basically is this. Krugman is talking about the supply-siders of the late 1970s, early 1980s, and supply-side tax policy under Ronald Reagan. And here's what Krugman has to say. He says, I'm not sure even now whether people who aren't involved in economic policy discussion understand that supply-side wasn't a doctrine like monetarism or even real business cycles, ideas I may think are wrong, but which had, and to some extent still have, significant support from professionals in the field. Supply-side economics never had any evidence behind it. It never had any support in academic research. It barely even had any support among economic researchers and forecasters in the business world. It was and remains crank economics, pure and simple, with nothing going for it except political convenience. Yet 35 years ago, the GOP was already willing to embrace this doctrine because it was politically convenient and could be used to justify tax cuts for the rich, which have always been the priority. And then Krugman goes on to say, but given that the GOP has been in thrall to, if we can even dignify it as a school of thought, according to Krugman, that is so at odds with reality, is it any surprise that the GOP is in constant reality denial in all kinds of fields? So that's your post from July 18th, 2016. So we are going to say a little something about supply-side economics because, in fact, when I do Q&A sessions from time to time, I get this a lot. Do the Austrians engage with the supply-siders? Are their views coincident? Is there overlap? Are they different? So, Bob, I'm going to kick this over to you.
Okay, well, thanks, Tom. This is actually another first. This is the first time that there's more than one real economist doing the show.
Oh.
All right. I have to just, I know the people at home are like, whoa, that escalated quickly. But you guys need to understand, Tom at Mises, you guys are feeding. He has the biggest ego already. Stop telling him how great he is and how much you love his stuff. You're making it worse. All right. So let me just get some context here. As usual, when Krugman says something to the effect that there is no evidence whatsoever for X, it means there's a lot of evidence for X, and I'm just going to be very particular in my definitions if you call me on my, I won't say lie, but exaggeration of saying things that do not coincide with the truth, put it that way. So on this issue, again, what does he mean? If what he means is by supply-side economics is the proposition that every reduction in tax rates will bring forth more absolute dollars in revenue, then okay, that's true. There's not much evidence for that proposition, even though, in case you don't know this, if you look at the what happened in the Reagan Revolution, it is true that federal revenues went up, right? So when you're trying to understand why did deficits explode in the Reagan years, it's not because of, quote, tax cuts for the rich. It's because Reagan, you know, in Congress and so on, let spending rise faster than revenues did. So make sure you're familiar with those basic facts. But more generally, I actually worked for Arthur Laffer for about a year, so I saw even his old research papers. Laffer, he's, you know, one associated with supply-side economics, the Laffer curve and so on. His claim was not that every tax rate reduction brings in more revenue. He was just saying you can't use a static analysis. You have to take into account a rate reduction changes incentives, enlarges the tax base, and so a static analysis will exaggerate the loss in revenue. Right? He wasn't saying, though, every tax cut pays for itself. Then let me just also talk about the issue of Krugman saying there's no evidence, this is all just crank stuff. Again, that's totally wrong. So if you look at, for example, just Google dynamic scoring CBO, you'll pull up a report from the Congressional Budget Office talking about dynamic scoring and how they do that in their assessments. And what does dynamic scoring means? It means we don't use a static analysis when we take into account, like, oh, how much if we repealed the Affordable Care Act, what would that do to the budget deficit over the next coming years? To say we're going to score it dynamically means we take into account if we change tax rates, then that might change behavior. And so, you know, that will affect how much revenue comes in. So the CBO is not some crank organization. That's the standard go-to place that assesses changes in policy. Greg Mankiw and a co-author whose name I don't know how to pronounce, so I'm just going to not say it. They have an MBER paper on tax cut changes and how you do dynamic scoring. So Greg Mankiw, again, not some crank economist in Krugman's world. But you say, all right, he's a Republican. Okay, Christina and David Romer had a famous paper that came out in 2007. The title of that was The Macroeconomic Effects of Tax Changes, showing, you know, they did some new approach and they found that, oh, there's large impacts from tax changes on economic behavior. All right, so this, we say this a lot, Tom, and I hit this point a lot, but what do progressive liberals want to do to stop climate change? They want to have a carbon tax. Why? Because a tax affects behavior. What do they want to do if they want to discourage people from smoking? Oh, put a big tax on it. And so what would happen if you want to discourage people from working? Why wouldn't you put a big tax on that, right? So this idea that, oh, it's some crank notion that raising tax rates on something discourages that activity, far from being a crank notion, that's standard stuff. And I've just listed all kinds of places that take that into account. Okay.
Also, I think the 1920s is a fairly good example of how this effect is evident. The tax rates were, the top marginal rates were quite high in the early 1920s following World War I. So a lot of people were not exposing their wealth to these tax rates, or they were putting a lot of money in tax-free municipal bonds or whatever. And then when Harding and Coolidge reduced the rates, they were willing to expose their money to these rates, and you did see this other activity. Now, of course, obviously, we don't care that the government gets more revenue. We're not saying that's a good thing. We're just saying, if Krugman says something that's wrong, it should be refuted. So that's what we're trying to do here. Now, from here, we want to jump off to some other topics. But I do want to give our distinguished guests an opportunity to jump in. Peter, you seem pretty eager. So, Peter Klein?
Wait, shouldn't we start with the distinguished guests?
Oh.
Now you're in our house.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, I rarely agree with Bob Murphy, but he's right that a lot of the specific policy proposals that Krugman seems to attack in this column are ones that almost every mainstream economist would agree with. But I'd go even farther and say, you know, as these guys know, and as you know, if you listen to this podcast, Krugman is the master of the straw man, right? And he's very slippery and cagey in what he does. So in this blog post On the one hand, he's right that supply-side economics is not a school of thought like Austrian economics or Keynesian economics with a distinct set of theoretical doctrines. The label supply-side economics just loosely refers to a set of policy proposals that that many people suggested in the 1980s as ways of spurring economic growth. For example, tax cuts for not only personal income tax cuts, but corporate income tax cuts, simplifying tax rates, and so forth. But if you think about it more broadly, the label supply-side economics essentially means policies that address the supply side of the economy rather than the demand side, right? Keynesian economics says the only thing that matters, not only for short-term economic fluctuations, but even for long-term economic performance, is the management of aggregate demand. And fiscal policy and monetary policy are all about aggregate demand, managing the demand side of the economy. Well, a lot of economists in the 1980s, as the Keynesian consensus was crumbling, said, well, you know, maybe the supply side of the economy matters too. Maybe we should think about policies that affect not only consumption, but also production, you know, big shock, things that discourage work, things that discourage corporate investment ought to matter. But what is also part of sort of supply side economics is things that all progressive economists seem to favor too, like, you know, policies that would improve performance, would improve the productivity of companies and industries, investments in education and infrastructure, training, job training, and so on. These are all supply-side policies, and Krugman, of course, is in favor of all of these, as are Obama, you know, all sorts of policy wonks on the Democratic as well as the Republican side. So, I mean, depending on what you mean by supply-side economics, yeah, pretty much everyone agrees that the supply side matters. So this is just sort of a rhetorical trick, I think, by Krugman to make supply-side economics sound like it's something other than it is so he can knock it down as being unscientific.
Wow, that was even better than what you said, Bob. That was really good.
Yeah. You should have me on the show more often instead of him.
Maybe we should go back to just having one trained economist on the show. I think that monopoly is good. I'm glad you pointed that out, Peter, because just where that term supply side comes from, you're right. It was a reaction against Keynesianism, which was demand side management. And also, I can't help but point out Krugman taking his shot that, the only reason supply side had any currency was because the politicians loved it. Not like there's any danger of that happening in terms of a doctrine that says government needs to spend more money. The politician's like, get that out of here.
Let me suggest for the people who are listening to the recording when this episode is released, they might not know Peter Klein is with Baylor University, which is not implicated in anything Peter says, of course. Lucas is with Kent State University, and Mark is here at the Mises Institute. Mark, you want to jump in?
Sure. One thing Krugman did say that's correct is there was really a small number of supply-siders. There were three guys, Arthur Laffer, Jude Wodinski, and one other guy who wrote books on supply-side economics. No one in academia really calls themselves a supply-sider. And the other thing I'll point out is I have a paper in the Review of Social Economy back in 1986 on supply-side tax cuts in the 1920s, and it showed that the economy reacted very favorably and very quickly to the four tax cuts that occurred during the 1920s.
I think one thing I'd add to what's been said so far is the supply side policies, they're associated with a very small group of people, but they're not just isolated in this group either. I think of when I was back in graduate school, one of the first things I learned in macroeconomics, we were doing some growth theory or something like that, we were looking at how you should tax, and the conclusion they came to was that taxing capital income is terrible. It destroys the growth of the economy. Right, so this should suggest that maybe we should cut capital gains taxes, that kind of thing. Cutting the taxes that we normally think the rich is paying is a good thing for growing the economy. And it wasn't a supply-sider teaching me this. It was a very mainstream, right, typical guy at a state university. So I'm baffled.
Yeah. By the way, on corporate tax rates, as I'm sure most of your listeners, being highly educated from listening to you, would know, the U.S. has among the highest corporate income tax rates in the developed world, even including some developing countries. I remember when Bernie Sanders a couple months ago was talking about making the U.S. more like Denmark, and Hillary Clinton said, I can't remember, they were arguing about who could be the most pro-Scandinavian and who could make America look more like Scandinavia. I remember tweeting sort of a smart alecky tweet, you know, Senator Sanders, yes, the U.S. should be more like Denmark. I forget the number. You know, Denmark has a corporate income tax rate of about 20%. The U.S. has one closer to 30%. I said, yeah, let's be more like Denmark. Cut the corporate income tax.
And he retweeted that, no doubt, right?
Oh, I'm sure he did.
By the way, episode...
He favorited it. And
episode number 6 of Contra Krugman, we take on the Bernie Sanders, shouldn't we be more like Denmark objection. So ContraKrugman.com/6.
Yeah, a little trivia about that. Tom and I were concerned. And we were like, well, we don't know anything about Denmark. But we were like, but neither does Krugman, so let's do this. That's a fair fight.
All right. I think it would be interesting now to use this, as I say, we'll use this as a jumping off point. Because sometimes when Krugman gives us thin gruel like this, we think, well, let's make this into a broader teaching moment for the listening audience. And one thing we might be able to talk about is free market economics in general, as opposed to Austrian economics in particular. There might be people who want to know, well, yeah, I believe in free market economics. Why are you so devoted to this particular school of thought? Isn't it really all the same? Don't we all favor something, you know, all the same sort of thing? And one of the questions I get a lot is, what's the difference between the Austrian and the Chicago schools, for example? So I guess we could take this in terms of, let's give some specific examples, but also talk about why it does matter. You know, why free market is not enough. Maybe that's the title of this episode. Free market is not enough. Anybody want to jump in on that? By the way, you know what won't be not enough?
The Contra Cruise.
Yeah, that's right. All right, we'll get to that later. Not everybody knows that joke yet. We'll ease them into it.
This is good. We can tell which of you listen to the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Or not.
Yeah. If you're laughing at those awkward segues, we know you listen.
Well, segueing from the supply side thing, I went to the first Federalist Society conference at the University of Chicago Law School in 1983. And little did I know, but I was supposed to be put up in the dorm room with one of the law students. And it was Bill Laffer, who is Art Laffer, the supply-sider's nephew. And we debated the entire weekend that I was there about, you know, he was saying, you know, what do you have to call it Austrian economics? Just free market economics. It's just like supply side. I said, well, no, it's not just like supply side. There's no business cycle theory, for example. And I said, you know, Austrians support a real gold standard. He said, oh, the supply siders support it too, but they support the phony gold standard. So this went on and on and on. And
do you mean like you're shaving and he's arguing with you during this conference?
What's that?
Like you're trying to shave in the room and he's arguing with you?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. Yeah, pretty much. Just would not let it go. But there are a lot of, obviously, there's a lot of differences in methodology.
Can you explain the difference in gold standard? Because that's a good example. Like,
okay.
What does it mean when some people say they're for gold standard, but you're saying, oh, that's the phony? What do you mean by that?
Well, Austrians generally support what we call the true gold standard, where there are actual gold coins in circulation and in bank vaults, where it's a physical amount of gold, where the dollar is defined as a physical amount of gold. As a matter of fact, we had an article on this by Frank Shostak on Mises.org this week, if you missed that. The supply-siders at the time advocated having a gold price standard where gold would be at $400 an ounce. This was obviously a long time ago. And the government would supply or demand gold in order to maintain that price of $400 an ounce. So it was a price-fixing scheme, and there's a lot of different problems associated with that, but it's much different because it's a government-managed system, not a market-managed system.
Well, to play up on what we were discussing before about supply-siders, I mean, again, the term free market economics makes me a little bit uncomfortable, right? Because economics is a scientific discipline that is value-free. Austrian economics is value-free, even though many people trained in Austrian economics support free markets, because Austrian economics helps us to see how free markets are better for human flourishing, are better for overall well-being than controlled markets. But you know, I kind of don't like the term. If you met someone who said, "Well, I'm an anti-global warming meteorologist," I mean, you would be a little bit suspicious, like, well, wait a minute, you're mixing kind of the type of study you do with the conclusions that you reach. I mean, defense support for the free market is a conclusion of Austrian economics and many other kinds of economics, plus some basic assumptions about human flourishing, namely that we think it's better than human suffering, right? But economics per se is not really a free market thing. And of course, I know what people mean when they say free market economics, and it's, I don't mean to make it sort of more harmful than it is, but I just want to clarify that there are a lot of people who say, I'm a free market economist. What they mean is, I support free market policies for various reasons, but they don't use economics in a sort of very careful way, or they're not engaged in economic analysis directly. They just have an affinity for free market policies, right, maybe for other reasons.
Okay, I appreciate that, and I understand your reluctance to embrace free market economics as a term. But let me play.
You asked that question anyway. I mean, what is your problem, buddy?
Let me play devil's advocate here a little bit. If you were teaching, I mean, I know you probably, you know, you don't do introductory courses, but if you were, and the subject of so-called externalities came up, or, you know, so we have air pollution or the guy with, you know, bad breath or whatever, and we have externalities, your approach would not be to say, so now I'll show you, you know, why this means that government needs to do this. You wouldn't do that. Why wouldn't you do that? Because you're a free market economist, right? You would teach it to them in a certain way that would not include, now let's make the defenses for what we all know is necessary, government intervention. You wouldn't. So therefore, you're a free market economist.
Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah. If free market economist means good economist rather than...
Fair enough.
Rather than
we're not saying that.
Propagandist, yeah, then I'm all for it.
All right, okay. All right, we'll get that settled.
Yeah, while we're talking about the distinction between like the Austrian Chicago School, another huge example, and to show that it really is important why people, if they say, I'm in the Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, why do I care about Austrian per se? A huge difference is their approach to monetary policy, as Mark was saying, and beyond just saying, okay, let's have a real gold standard or versus a phony one, their explanation of the Great Depression, right? So Friedman and Anna Schwartz famously said the Great Depression was caused because the Fed didn't inflate enough, that through the 20s, anytime there was a hiccup in the economy, the Fed rushed in with new liquidity and got it going, and that's all that needed to happen. But for various reasons, somebody died and so on, and there was a power vacuum at the Fed. It was asleep at the wheel, and it amazingly sat back while broader monetary areas collapsed in the early 30s. And if only the Fed had come in and inflated more, then we wouldn't have had the Great Depression. Whereas the Austrians, it's almost the exact opposite. Murray Rothbard famously arguing that the Fed was inflating in the 20s. That's what blew up the stock bubble, which then had to come crashing down, and that's what caused the great contraction in the early 30s. So there, I mean, that is a huge example of a difference. We're not just nitpicking on methodological issues, though we are happy to nitpick on methodological issues also.
In many ways, Austrian economists, Chicago School economists, other people who would identify with sort of different free market movements, we agree on a lot of analysis and policy, especially at the microeconomic level, but we Austrians are more consistent. Right, so we take our price theory, our value theory, our understanding of markets, and we use that all the way through as we're talking about macroeconomic phenomena, money, business cycles, growth, and so forth. Whereas a lot of other economists, they sort of flip. It's like if you ask even a lot of Keynesian economists to talk about, you know, the market for shoes, they would understand it in a way that's not totally different from the way we Austrians would understand it. And they would say, yeah, of course, the market can produce the right quantity and quality and variety of shoes and can be priced in such a way that many different people can buy shoes of different kinds and so forth. But then you say, well, what about money? Oh, well, money's totally different. The market can't produce money because of some hand-waving, you know, Ayn Rand would say blank out, right? Or what about other goods and services? What about so-called public goods? What about lighthouses? And what about... you know, generation of information or scientific research or national defense, right? Austrian economists will often say, well, let me analyze that using the same kind of theories and methods and techniques I would use to analyze the shoe market, although, of course, there may be important institutional differences, whereas a lot of mainstream economists, even Chicago and other kind of free market types, will say, oh, well, wait a minute, you know, now I've got to use a totally different kind of model, or I start with the assumption that, well, of course, the government has to supply money. Of course, the government has to supply XYZ because it's just a totally different thing from other goods and services.
How about the question about monopoly theory? D- differentiating Chicago and Austria? And where does that come from? Why do they not have the same, why don't they reach the same conclusions about monopoly that somebody like Rothbard reaches in Man, Economy, and State?
Okay, well, the Chicago School, their monopoly theory, there are similarities between their theory and the standard theory and Austrians. Basically, mainstream economists will argue that it's either government interventions, monopoly privileges granted by the government, or it's specific market conditions that are unique to a particular good or industry that allows for monopolies to exist, allows for market power to exist. In Murray Rothbard's analysis, building on Mises' analysis of monopoly, basically Rothbard argued that all monopolies are created by government intervention and the granting of monopoly privileges in the economy. So there's important differences, obviously, between the two. And Rothbard argues that that basically you cannot generate a monopoly in the free market.
I think another way you could say that is a label some people use instead of Austrian economics is causal realist economics, because Austrians believe in trying to trace out cause and effect throughout the economy, which is why we don't use a lot of math, right? And we also are interested in explaining real markets, the real economy. Neoclassical economists, including Chicago economists, are more interested in unrealistic models of the economy, especially this horrible thing that we need to get rid of, so-called perfect competition. So the perfect competition model has been an albatross around the necks of economists for many years. And I think Chicago school types, they hold up this perfect competition, this perfectly competitive situation as an ideal. And so to them, monopoly is like a dirty, messy corruption of this ideal state. And so, yeah, we don't like government in general, but yeah, we do want the government to try to take away monopoly and these other things and make us more like perfect competition. Whereas Austrians recognize there's no such thing as a perfectly competitive market. You know, all sellers have a product that is somewhat different from that of other sellers, not to be too technical. As Marx said, the way Rothbard puts it, all sellers have a downward sloping demand curve. And so unless you get a special privilege from the government, right, we can analyze you just the same way we analyze any producer. We don't need a separate monopoly theory to go, you know, to add on to our competition theory, except in the case where the government gives you an exclusive grant.
There's a really good chapter on this subject of perfect competition that I remember years ago I really enjoyed. It really helped me understand what the problems with it were. And it's in this obscure book by Milton Shapiro. I think it's called The Foundations of the Market Price System, something like that. One of the last chapters. You can find it online at Mises.org. Just really demolishes that perfect competition model. You want to say?
Well, are you done with that?
I'm done with that, but I have another thing to say. I can wait.
It's my show, too.
Well... I mean, today you're actually making some good points. We should write this on the calendar.
Oh, hey.
Actually, I stole that joke from him when he used that against me a few weeks ago. So don't boo me. That was his joke.
No, boo him for using my joke from 2 weeks ago. All right. So this reminds me, again, another big difference. And it's you might say, I can imagine some people hearing this and saying, oh, okay, so you guys are the real dogmatic ones. The Chicago School at least acknowledges the possibility that there could be a role for government to combat pollution or to build, you know, nuclear weapons and so on. I mean, because it's true, you can't trust politicians to make shoes, but give them nuclear weapons. That makes a lot of sense. But on an issue where I think Austrians are quite reasonable and have common sense, and the Chicago School is very exaggerated, has come to like financial markets, and Eugene Fama, guys like that, put forward what's considered the efficient markets hypothesis. And as a hypothesis and a benchmark to start the analysis in the classroom, that's great. That's a good starting point, but it leads to absurdities in practice where, for example, as of 2009 and 10, there are several people out of that Chicago School tradition who say there was no housing bubble because bubbles can't exist by definition, or you give me an operational definition that could do anything, because if we were in a bubble and everyone knew it, then the bubble would pop. Like, that's the kind of argument they use. And you understand there's a certain logic to it, saying how could it be that we all know assets are overpriced, because then wouldn't we sell them? But then they just move on and say, okay, so therefore stop telling me that low interest rates are fueling an asset bubble because that doesn't mean anything to me. When clearly I think Austrians recognize, no, the Fed pumping in money has something to do with why markets go way up and then crash. And they don't just have this almost tautologist way of just inoculating the market and saying that can't be. There must be something else going on here.
One example I'd like to use to differentiate the mainstream from the Austrians in terms of competition and monopoly. About 100 years ago, people started making automobiles and colas, Coca-Cola, for example. And there would be, you know, in every little town, in every big town, there would be people who were building cars by hand, one at a time. So you'd have two or three guys in a garage making parts, putting together into the engine and the car. Likewise with colas, people were making up their own recipes and selling colas. And there were thousands and thousands of these automobile companies and as well hundreds and hundreds of these soda companies all over the place. And that's what mainstream economics likes. They like, you know, an unlimited number of producers out there in the economy with no effect, no ability to affect the market price and so on. Nowadays, of course, we have just a couple of cola companies and just a couple of automobile companies here in the United States. So now we have a small number of sellers, and the mainstream opposes that because that creates market power or monopoly power. So they would like the initial stages where you've got thousands of individual firms. They don't like what exists today because there's a small number of firms, despite the fact that everybody knows that automobiles are so much better nowadays and relatively inexpensive. So they like the early stage. They don't like the current stage. But Austrians view the whole thing of the industry starting and consolidating, improving the product, reducing the relative price of automobiles over time. We think the whole thing is competition.
You know where else there'll be a small number of cola sellers?
The Contra Cruz. You betcha. All right. Look, do we want to tell them what's going on here?
I kind of think we're supposed to.
Yeah, I guess we have no choice at this point. All right, so October 9th through the 16th of this year, Bob and I are hosting a six-night cruise. That is correct. Aboard Royal Caribbean's Liberty of the Seas, if you can believe that. And I'd love you all to think that we planned it that way, but if only Bob were that competent, we might be able to. But it's going to be, we have so much fun stuff planned for it, and you can visit ContraCruise.com to find out about it, and then tell your parents, it's very important for my education that I go on this cruise, and we'll see if we can outfit you. But the key thing is the awkward segue. That's the whole thing, is how do we bring up the cruise during the show? Well, we just come up with these ridiculously absurd ways of, like, we were talking about Brexit. And I said, Bob, you know something you would not want to secede from? The Contra Cruise. See? That's the thing. So on the cruise, we're actually going to give a prize to the person who has the best, most classic transition. You don't really have to promote the cruise when you're on it, but you got to tell that joke in order to get the prize. So anyway, ContraCruise.com.
We're all going on the cruise for free, aren't we, your guest panelists?
Yeah, I'm sorry. The audio seems to have gone out just there. Sorry. Let me add one thing I've noticed. This could just be because it's a small sample size in terms of Chicago people I know, but doesn't there seem to be a temperamental difference between a lot of Austrians and a lot of Chicago people? The Austrians, if you were to go out for drinks with them and talk to them about their views, their view would be that the state is evil. It's evil. It's not like let's see if we can help them to fine-tune it and make things work for us better. It's evil and we have to oppose it. But if I took Chicago people out, they would say, well, you know, a lot of times the government is full of a bunch of jokers, isn't it? And they sure do a lot of things that are silly and wrong, and private solutions do seem to work better. And even David Friedman, who's a very smart guy, and I like him, but he's got Chicago influences, he's an anarchist. And even he doesn't really, you don't get the sense that he just hates the state. So what do you think the source of that is? Where's the direction? Is it that Austrian economics makes you this way, or is that you're already this way and that draws you to Austrian economics?
It sounds like Tom's saying we're a bunch of haters, doesn't it?
of evil.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but you're right. There is a difference in temperament. I think a lot of Austrian economists, at least those of us in the room here, I would say we're very good at doing technical economics, but what really attracted us to this field of study was some kind of passion or really a desire to make the world a better place and to understand how the world works. And we really do have this kind of drive. It's really a big deal. We think about it all the time. There are a lot of economists, even, as you say, economists who are sympathetic to free markets, who do economics as a 9-to-5 job. I mean, they're kind of technicians or technocrats. They're interested in doing modeling and collecting data and solving little clever puzzles and things. But I don't think they have that same drive or passion. Now, whether that's self-selection or whether, as you say, there's something about studying Austrian economics that makes you more passionate, I don't exactly know, but I'd like to have more people studying Austrian economics so we could do that experiment.
And I don't think their people take a week off in their summer to come to Alabama to study their kind of economics. By the way, that was a compliment to you all, so if you felt like applauding, you could. All right. Hey.
Yeah. It could be some of you are like, yeah, tell me about it, you know? I think just an anecdote to follow up on what Peter was saying. When I was in grad school, so I was at NYU, and it was a very international program, and it was funny. The one other American guy and I, we were, like, studying for the things that we hadn't been prepared mathematically for the exam to kind of weed people out. And he said, there's going to be ethnic cleansing at the end of this, Bob, thinking we were going to get... we were watching it was the Olympics that year, and we were watching it over this Italian woman's house, and we were sitting there watching, and these are all my first year classmates, and I was just making conversation. I said something like, okay, guys, and they were really into the Olympics, like more than I was, and I said, if you could either win the Nobel Prize in economics or win a gold medal in some Olympic event, which would you choose? And they were looking at me like that was the dumbest question. I said, a gold medal, of course. And so, I mean, that kind of surprised me, whereas, you know, there I was nerdy and thinking, you know, well, no, I went into, I'm the life of the mind or whatever, you know. I could have been a star athlete, but I chose not to, you know. So, but that just kind of, I was making a conversation, but I was surprised by how they were just like, that's not even close. Why would you even ask that? That to them, like Peter was saying, it was, yeah, this is interesting. My government's going to fund me to go study, and I'll come back and help the central bank and, you know, do. So they thought they were helping and so forth, but it was not that they were out there to, like, change the world, I don't think. That's not why they went into economics.
I also wonder, like, back to the question of why is it we really think government is evil, right, compared to these Chicago guys. I wonder how much of it is the influence of Murray Rothbard, too, that, you know, being a great Austrian economist, doing the value-free stuff, but also having his, like, libertarian philosophy writings that a lot of us have read, right, where we see property rights as not just being something that gives us a nice outcome, but that is actually, like, morally good. So violations of these rights are actually evil, right? It's not just, oh, we're making the economy less efficient than it could possibly be, but you're actually violating people's rights, and we get enraged by this.
Yeah, I got another thing on that when we study markets, right, we really make a sharp distinction between voluntary interaction, peaceful cooperation among people, and violent interaction. You know, if I punch Murphy in the face, which I've been tempted to do many times, you know, I mentioned this in my lecture yesterday, you know, we wouldn't refer to that as a negative externality, right? We would say, you know, we would haul me off to the slammer or whatever. I think a lot of mainstream economists, including Chicago economists, they don't recognize an intrinsic distinction between voluntary interaction and coercion. And they would say, oh, yeah, well, we can apply our models to punching Bob in the face. That's just another outcome. It lowers Bob's utility. It may increase Peter's utility. In fact, Ronald Coase, the great Chicago economist, Ronald Coase was very explicit about this. He wanted to banish the notion of causation altogether from economic analysis. And he said, look, it's no different. You could say, yeah, Klein caused Murphy's bloody nose by punching him in the face. But you could also say Murphy caused his own bloody nose by his failure to duck at just the right moment. And analytically, those are really identical. And, you know, whether Klein should have to compensate Murphy for his injury or not really just depends on who could have avoided this harm at a lower cost. If Murphy could have ducked more easily than I could have, you know, withheld my punch or, you know, then it's his own fault. I mean, but I think this ties into what you're saying, that they don't view that kind of a situation as any different from, you know, tax policy and pricing or purely voluntary exchange, you know, buying shoes and so forth. We really do see a difference.
Yeah, on this point, not the point of him punching me, the broader point, he's not setting up a straw man there. If you guys have never read this, you should go look at, like, the economic analysis of crime from a Chicago school point of view, and they will be quite explicit, like, doing a cost-benefit analysis. They'll get mad saying a lot of people think when you analyze the cost and benefits of certain policies about crime to not count the utility to the thieves from getting money. And they're saying that's, you know, that's, so in their mind, they're saying you have to be fair. And if, you know, muggers get a thrill from mugging people besides just the money, that goes into it. So that's a benefit from mugging to be offset, of course, by if there's people out there who don't like being mugged, well, then you take that into account too. We're being fair and balanced. But so that it's not a straw man he's setting up. And there is a certain logic to that where you say, no, we're being value free. Who are we to say that the people who have the money in the first place because they went out and earned it, that that's their money? No, that's a value judgment. So you get the logic of what they're doing, but it's kind of freaky where that ends up leading, especially if it's involving a punch to my face.
Yeah. And
I feel very strongly about that.
No straw man. I mean, what do you think I am, Paul Krugman? Yeah.
But couldn't they make an argument that they're the ones who are being value-free, and the fact that we refuse to acknowledge the utility to the thief means that we're sneaking in an ethical proposition there, that only the utility that's lost by the victim is worth counting. Isn't that making an or likewise, the fact that a lot of our analysis kind of takes for granted private property. I mean, like, I could probably find some ethical, sneaky ethical assumptions even in Austrian economics. Am I wrong? I mean, I know I'm wrong. I want to know why I'm wrong.
I think we could weasel out of your objection and be a little bit more technical and say, well, Austrians consider as relevant to this sort of policy assessment only valuations that can be demonstrated in action, right? And if we're talking about a monetary economy, things that can be priced in the market and so forth. So we would say, yeah, I mean, Bob says he gets, or I say I get utility from punching Bob. That's not something that we can really price out. So in other words, we know that the fact that Bob did not, you know, punch himself or bring himself to me to be punched, we can make a statement that Bob prefers, we can observe that Bob prefers not being punched to being punched. That's enough. The fact that Bob might say in an interview later or a survey, oh, but yeah, sometimes I actually do like to be punched, we would say that's not really relevant. Scientifically, that doesn't matter. That's why we only look at people's, you know, we only try to infer well-being from what people do in situations of voluntary exchange.
Boy, that is such a good answer. I feel better already about Austrian economics. That's good.
This is kind of a weird episode.
let me
make sure that we're not setting up a storm. I want to. So, in reference to your point, you're right, Tom, and that's exactly what they would say. They're saying, yeah, we're not bringing in value judgments, and they would think they're giving a more solid footing to the proposition that theft should be illegal. So the way they would do it is to say, look, it's a pure transfer. If a thief breaks into your house and takes a $100 television set, then the thief is up $100 worth of wealth and the owner's down. Or even if you get more specific, say it's not really worth as much to the thief because, you know, he's got to go resell it somewhere and it's a stolen good and things like that. So at best, that's a pure transfer. But now if thievery is allowed like that, then people are going to have to waste resources having more locks and setting up security cameras. So that is the reason a mainstream economist would say using pure cost benefit, we can show why widespread theft is a bad thing, and so we want to enact policies that discourage it, blah, blah, blah. But that's, I think, where a lot of Austrian libertarians reject sort of what they would call crude Benthamite utilitarianism. Murray Rothbard in particular said, yeah, you might be able in the beginning to come up with the right answer using that framework, but then you've lost your moorings and you're going to end up possibly miscalculating and then justifying something that actually is morally reprehensible. Whereas coming from, he would say, a natural law tradition, deriving rights in that fashion is much safer and more likely to lead you to what the correct answer is. So it's not an arbitrary thing. We kind of just know, like, if your cost benefit led to the fact that, yeah, it's fine to go drown kittens for fun and there's nothing morally weird about that, you would kind of just say, that can't be right. We got the wrong answer. And so I think Rothbard would say, so why would you put your eggs in the basket of this crude calculation when you know it might go awry and you need your sort of common sense moral intuitions to check that?
In doing policy analysis, we're acting not only as Austrian economists, but also as human beings who have ethical judgments and who hold particular values, I have no problem whatsoever with somebody saying, well, you know, you think you shouldn't punch Bob Murphy in the face. You've snuck in some ethical judgments as into your value-free analysis. I'm like, yeah, I did. So what?
Yeah, so of all things to sneak into your analysis, not punching right. Bob. Like that's
it's
the
weird
only
that Austrian economics rests on the foundation that you can't hit me.
Yeah. Story. How about that? How about that? All right, listen, I think if I may summarize what everyone's been saying, the supply-siders had more to say for themselves than Krugman gives them credit for. That's really what we've been driving at for most of this this late morning. But we did use the column to jump off to talk about some other things that I think are on the minds of some folks here. You've been talking mostly Austrian economics all week, except when there have been some comparative talks, and you may want to know, well, what are the differences, and, you know, is it, I'll have to use the term free market economics. Is it enough to be a free market economist, or is there more to think about here? So I want to thank Mark Thornton, Lucas Engelhardt, Peter Klein, and you know what? I'll even thank Bob Murphy. What the heck, right? If you can't hit him, thank him. All right. Check out our show notes page. We'll link to the column, and we'll try to link to something interesting related to what we were just talking about, ContraKrugman.com/45, and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so that you can hear our smackdowns of Krugman in weeks when he gives us something to smack down. So thank you very much, everybody. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Contra Krugman. Subscribe to the show for free on iTunes or Stitcher at ContraKrugman.com. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, our blog, books by Tom and Bob, and more at ContraKrugman.com. See you next week.